First item on the agenda is approval of the minutes. Representative Vogel?
Madam Chair, I would move approval.
All in favor of approval of minutes as printed, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. The item two on the agenda, the State Auditor's Volunteer Fire Relief Association Work Group bill. I move that we vote the recommendations and House File 2373 be recommended to pass and incorporated into the omnibus pension bill. Is there any discussion? Representative Limmer, or Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, what are these recommendations that we're voting on?
They're the same recommendations that we discussed at last week's meeting in depth with the report.
All right. I wasn't here at that time, Madam Chair.
So there.
I'll catch up.
Thank you.
We're doing the bill, not the
right.
The working group bill. Yeah.
The working group bill.
The state office.
And they made their report last week, and we had. But I do know that before we vote on the motion that's before us, Jeff Skime wants to testify. Jeff?
Yes.
And you'll pronounce your name for me.
Yes. I'm new at this, folks, Madam Chair.
So are we.
Yeah. My name is Jeff Skime. I represent myself as a member of the Bemidji Volunteer Fire Department Relief Association. Our family's been in the firefighting business, I guess, trade for close to 150 years. As you guys are well aware of what's going on with the shortage of firefighters and the solution with the recommendations that has come out, I am very opposed to it. The survey that was sent on out involved the 78 combination departments. It never went to the departments themselves and to the individuals. The firefighters as a whole are really unaware of what is going on this and how it will affect them. This is the only funding that these volunteer fire departments do have. Our department alone, it will take a reduction of 25%. A couple years back, we just had a supplementary added to our retirement. It's pushing us right backwards again. So I just want to go on record that this really needs more time. It really, really does. And I don't know if this is the right procedure, right place, or whatever, but I have to voice that. And thank you for your time.
Mr. Skime, you're welcome to stay there and talk on the next agenda item.
Oh, okay.
You're talking about LCRPR 119030.
Okay.
So you're just a little ahead of me.
Yeah, a lot of paperwork for me.
Okay.
Thank you.
That's right. The House File 2373, Senate Files 2491, as reported to the Commission. In bill form, the motion is to include it in the omnibus bill. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I recall during our, when we heard this, whenever it was last week or 2 weeks ago, we had two issues that we were discussing And I'm wondering if, I don't know that we had a consensus on either of those issues. One was the length of time for vesting, I believe, was in this bill, am I correct? And also the issue of augmentation, that this would be the only relief associations continuing to provide augmentation.
Ms. Lincheski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Pappas, that is correct. We did have a discussion about augmentation and vesting last week. The vesting change appears in sections 6 and 8 of the bill. And we talked about the fact that while the changes in the bill, let me see if I can find this. Section 6. Okay, thank you. Page 8, I believe, is section 6, and then a little bit further on is section 8. So even with these changes, which would allow for shorter vesting schedules, so as you can see, it would allow a relief association to change its bylaws to allow members to start vesting at 5 years and then become 100% vested at 10 years, it still does allow, as you can see earlier on in the provision here, it still does allow relief associations to impose a 20-year vesting schedule. That is, these in Section 6 apply to the defined contribution plans, and Section 8 applies to the defined benefit plans. So that was the one issue.
Right. Madam Chair, these are the recommendations of the working group, correct, in the bill form? So, I mean, I'm just kind of reluctant to disagree with the working group too strongly because I know they spent a lot of time and hours working on this. It just does seem to me, though, that if this option is still for 20 years, I mean, I think reasonable people can disagree. Is it easier to recruit people to come if you have shorter vesting period, or is it easier to keep them to stay longer if they're waiting to be vested? And I think that's kind of the difference here. So I don't think at this time I'm going to make a motion, but I do think this is something we should keep an eye on.
And it can be discussed.
Maybe get some more input and ask them to look at it some more about what is really best for recruitment and retention.
Senator Frantz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to echo Senator Pappas' concerns. If I took the auditor's testimony correctly, she did not want to address the issue of what might help recruitment, and I wonder whether a wider amount of flexibility might be provided in the bill, and I'm just sort of echoing. I think we ought to take a closer look. If our goal is recruitment and retention, then you'd have to say if the private sector allows 3 years to vest, what is it about volunteer firefighters that would make it easier to recruit with five? I'm not sure the auditor really addressed that issue, and so I think these are the work group recommendations. Whether they're best for the state of Minnesota on this issue, I think, is another question. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Ms. Hennessy.
You got it.
It just blank. Ms. Hennessy Allen.
Madam Chair, Senator. After last week's meeting, we did go back and review the data that Rose Hennessy Allen, Pension Director with the Office of the State Auditor. We did go back and review the data that we have, and currently there are only two relief associations in the state that require 20 years for vesting, so it's a very small number. And we have added this topic to our list of topics for consideration by the working group when it reconvenes in the fall.
Okay. And Ms.
Hennessy
Allen, it's been a long day. Last week, we also said that the working group presented items to this commission only if there was consensus.
Madam Chair, that's correct. Proposals only go into the working group bill if there's unanimous consent among all the members.
May I speak to the augmentation?
Yeah. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then maybe Ms. Lincheski could point out where the augmentation language is, or maybe it's not even in here because they didn't change it.
Yeah.
Ms. Lenteski.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Pappas. So this is at Section 9 of the bill, which is on page 12. Mm-hmm. It talks about deferred service pensions. Mm-hmm. And it does, the reason for the changes here are to fix really a word, to change pay to credit. Mm-hmm. But it brings to mind the fact that the relief associations still are permitted under this section to credit augmentation or to provide for this interest increase every year on a deferred vested pension. So as we mentioned last week, or as I mentioned last week, that was removed for all of the public pension plans in the state. These similarly are funded by taxpayer funds. They don't have any employee contributions, and I think most of them, at least not any of them currently. And so I think there's a similar situation here, which is what you're referring to.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so given the uniqueness of this process, maybe Ms. Tennessee Allen, you could put that on the agenda, too, for the fall, and kind of getting a fair warning that the Pension Commission might be interested in having more conformity here with other pension systems.
Madam Chair, Senator, we will do that.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just want to get a little bit of background on a couple of things. We heard three different working group studies last week. We heard the one from the state auditor. We also had heard the one from the state fire aid group, I think, which was the auditors. No, I take that back. That's the second one. Then we also heard the Relief Association conversion and dissolution work group information. The question that I have is, are those three separate silos of activities, or are they somewhat interdependent? And the reason I ask that question is, if we move forward with the House File 2373 and incorporate that into the pensions bill, and then we continue to work on some of the other areas, are we ever going to come back and say we wish we would have done something differently based on the work group's outcomes, because we don't have the other two legs of the stool that we're trying to resolve as it relates to this broader area of fire relief at the local level? And so I'm a little hesitant to support inclusion of something in here if we have two other legs of the stool that we're going to be looking at, so we don't have to come back and try to correct state statute, retrain everybody on a new set of rules. Does it make sense to hold off, continue to collect information and hold off until the interim when this commission, which has met for three or four times, could work on something in the interim, come back in the 2020 session with more information to be able to move forward and make a decision that makes a lot more sense so that we don't have one leg longer or shorter on the stool, which we have a problem. And so maybe staff can help me to understand if this is a standalone component or if all three of them may be integrated or interdependent by the time we get done with those.
Ms. Lenteski.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I would view the other two work groups as being interrelated. I think there was a lot of cross-referencing and people in one group were in the other group and a lot of discussion about how they should move at the same time. The state auditor's bill, I think, is not so much related. I don't think there's that many crossovers with the other two groups. I leave it to the commission to decide whether you want to have a broader look at things, including, say, the vesting, and that could be part of the other work group review. But I think this is probably more of a standalone than the other two.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, Madam Chair, then I'm going to change my metaphor from the three-legged stool to the teeter-totter with the two remaining bills that we have to keep them in equilibrium and make sure that we're working and not doing something where we're going to wish we would have. It is my hope that we will take those two then and delay those into the interim to be able to get a better chance to work on the information and the outcome on this. And I ask this now because this is the first bill that we're looking at with the state auditor's report that I don't want to miss an opportunity to 3 months from now, say after session's done, say, gosh, I wish we'd have done something different. And I kick myself for not asking this question tonight. So with that, Madam Chair, if we want to break these out and if staff feels that this is a standalone, we certainly can go with that. But I have very big concerns about moving any of the other stuff since it is so interrelated and it's complex when you start getting down to the individual communities and the plans that they have and some of those kinds of issues. I think we need to measure twice and cut once, to use another metaphor on that.
Kicking and cutting and measuring. All right. I accept your advice, Ms. Hennessy. Alan, do you have any further advice?
Madam Chair, I don't think I have any further.
And are you comfortable with the state auditor's report or working group report as a bill?
Madam Chair, I am comfortable. We are comfortable with the bill and agree that it is, we purposefully tried to keep what is in this bill separated from the two temporary work groups that we're meeting.
Okay. Is there any further discussion? Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on the issue? If not, I'll renew the motion to include House File 2373, Senate File 2491 be recommended to pass and be incorporated into the Omnibus Pension Bill. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. And I believe that will be the bill with additions, other additions to come.
Madam Chair, this is the vehicle bill that you're using? This House File 2373?
I believe so.
You're not introducing a new bill. Okay.
It's a number. A second item on the agenda is, or the third item, LCPR 19030, implementing the recommendations of the Fire State Aid Work Group. Representative O'Driscoll.
I raised my hand. I didn't mean to. My previous statements stand. Nothing's changed in the last 90 seconds since I shared my thoughts about the remaining two work groups being put together and worked on when the commission has more time to dig in and ask questions and get, if you will, the best answers that we can.
So you would prefer that this be laid over for possible inclusion or further discussion?
Madam Chair, I would appreciate it if it be laid over for further investigation by this committee and commission, along with some of the other things. I certainly know that we've had a number of issues, but again, many of them can be unique at the local level. But I think we want to try to work to find a statewide solution for all of our communities. And I fear that if we go too far down the road with one, we may leave something else behind, and we wish we'd have done things differently. And if we get our best product and then make tweaks in the future statutes, that makes sense versus having to try to chase ourselves in the statute for stuff that we didn't take the time to do the full work up on.
Mr. Skime, would you come forward, please? This is the bill that you're recommending that we not adopt tonight. And Representative O'Driscoll is voicing the opinions of several members on the commission that they would like to talk about this further and perhaps talk about it over the summer.
Okay.
And prepare a maybe different result or the same result for the next year's bill. Were you more comfortable with that than adopting it tonight?
Yes, Madam Chair. Okay. Yes. So I've got a contact person now, Mr. Driscoll, and I think you heard me earlier. It's a very, very complex situation, and it does not help retention at all because it pulls backwards, just pulls backwards on it. But anyway, thank you for your time, folks.
And we'll invite you to participate when we talk about it again over the summer.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. This bill will be laid over. Item 4, Representative Sundin, House File 2310, Senator Rarick, Senate File 2366. You have an amendment tonight.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The amendment should be in your packet there for 2310. What's protocol, Madam Chair? Who moves the amendment? Who moves the bill?
Whoever feels compelled to help you out. Senator Rosen.
So move.
Senator Rosen moves adoption of the amendment.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I just wanted the Pension Commission to know that Senator Rarick's our very newest member of the Senate. And usually, well, we have a tradition sometimes in the Senate on welcoming Senator Rarick to different committees with bills. And Senator Rosen prematurely put his bill into action here. Just wanted you to know. We have certain ways of doing things in the Senate.
And you waited till she got out of the room?
Well, I tried to talk fast, but I've been accused of that.
Madam Chair.
I suppose we'll let this opportunity go by.
Madam Chair.
In the House,
we have a completely different tradition, not just introducing. The member who is presenting before the commission or committee for the first time usually brings treats. Senator Rarick, how do we do on that tonight?
Madam Chair, actually, I've presented to this committee once before as a representative, so I think that qualifies.
Well, I will let the chair make that decision, whether that qualifies or not.
The chair loathes those traditions, either one, because in this case, the senator was duly elected, and we're all in the same place. And the representative who is the chair does not feel that anything should be presumed to happen that would look like we were bought off in any way. And so I don't believe in treats at a meeting. And whatever custom the Senate has to welcome the new senator, we welcome you. Senator.
Madam Chair, it's been said that when Senator Rarick moved from the House to the Senate, he raised the intelligence level of both bodies.
Madam Chair, do we have any other business before?
Madam Chair, can we get a roll call on that?
So we have before us the amendment to LCPR 19-0301A. Is that right?
No.
No, I don't even have it.
You're on number four.
Oh, that's fine. I'm sorry.
That's okay. It's this amendment.
I'm sorry, Representative Sundin. House 23101A is the amendment to 2310 House file. Representative Sundin.
I never knew that these pension issues could be so convoluted and complicated, Madam Chair. And when these funds have been altered or changed or retired or whatever you want to, however you want to put it, and there's some leftover money, it's got to be distributed equitably. And Mr. Kerry Farrell from Brevard Township found that that certainly wasn't the case, and he's going to outline the problem for us, and then we can hear from APERA, and maybe there's a solution, but I believe 2310 solves that as amended, and I'm going to rely on Ms. Lincheski for any technical answers on this bill. So if you would welcome Carrie Farrell, Chair and Supervisor of the Town of Brevator.
Thank you. Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Farrell. I used to represent Brevator for many a day. Both sides of the river, two fire halls, two community centers. Welcome to the commission.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I know you've been up there in the past as well, and future, hopefully. As Mr. Sundin mentioned, I'm the chair of the Board of Brevator, been on it since 2002. This really has no effect on me. I'm not a volunteer fireman. I've worked in public service for 25 years on the law enforcement side. Brevator Township joined the statewide volunteer pension plan to PARA in 2013. With that, we were locked into a payout for 5 years. Like any volunteer fire departments, we struggled to get members to participate. Our numbers dwindled. We tried through sending out mass mailings to all of our members of the township asking for volunteers. We put advertisements on our halls, and our numbers just dwindled where we could not answer our calls for service. We began discussing joining the Cloquet Area Fire District in 16 and 17. In 2017, the district was starting to take some of our calls as we could not respond, and we officially joined the Cloquet Area Fire District on 1-1 of 18. That, in fact, ended Brevator's having a volunteer fire department. We were no longer an active department. Also on 1-1 of 18 was the end of the 5 years for our locked-in amount to pay out upon retirement. We wanted to change that payout due to a higher number. Discussions with PARA, Dave Andrews at PARA, on running different numbers for us, it was learned that we could not change that number as we were no longer an active fire department without having legislation to change that. My apologies for that. It was learned through Dave. He put me in contact with Susan. I'm going to butcher your last name, Lewinsky. By the time her and I got into discussion, it was pretty late in last year's legislation session, so nothing got done. October 31st, the town clerk got an email that legislation had been changed, allowing Brevator Township to transfer its funds into the Cloquet Area Fire District's account. Not sure where that came from, as that was not authorized by the Board of Supervisors. When she provided that email to me as a chair at our board meeting in November, I said, I will take care of this. It brings up what we wanted to do at the beginning of the year to change it. I had contact with Susan to what the board's wishes were on paying out all of our members to absolve the fund. As so noted, Susan and I began to email back and forth. We had a phone conversation with PARA. The township passed a resolution in November. Our resolution number 226 was to terminate our pension plan, withdrawal of all the firefighters from coverage by PARA, the full vesting of all the firefighters with at least 1 year of service, an increase in the benefit level. The increase would be cited by PARA. That would leave no assets left in our account, and immediate distribution of that plan to all qualified members of the no longer dissolved department. A bill was forwarded to me from Ms. Lewinsky. I read it. There was a couple of changes that I noted. Those changes were made. Now I've reviewed it as well, and I think it meets everything that the Brevator Township is wishing to see done with our funds. It, I think, mirrors some of federal statutes that allows it to close out our funds. And I think in speaking with Mr. Sundin and Ms. Walensky, this bill kind of mirrors some of those federal statutes. It's our hope that this gets passed this evening so we can absolve that fund. I also believe that the township is not going to be around in 20 years if we were to wait to pay out until people reach the age of 50. That's part of the rationale in getting it paid out now. My reason being for that is you get lack of volunteers to do anything nowadays. Once myself or our clerk leaves, we're going to struggle to find anyone to replace us on our township level. What happens with this money then? You know, who oversees it? We would like to give it to the individuals that earned it. We have an individual right now that has 3 years on a service. Under the current wording, if we were an active department, he'd get nothing. He's done more work than the guys that have 20 years on. It's not fair that he gets nothing. And for the members that don't have the 5 years, if we were a department to be vested, they weren't given the opportunity to earn that 5 years of service. We took that from them and we abolished our department, which we didn't have a choice to do. We had to provide fire services. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Farrell. Mr. Anderson? Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, Madam Chair, just a couple of questions for the Chair, if I could. Thank you for coming down and being here this evening with us. When you dissolved your township fire department and you merged with the Cloquet District, did any of your members on that fire department become members of the district fire squad or fire team?
Representative, there was a couple that transferred over to the Cloquet Area Fire District and are still active members of the fire district.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Farrell, were you required to do anything with them moving over to help vest them on their schedule in this liquidation or in this transition, or do they start out at 00 in service, if you will, for the district?
Their service ended with us on the date of our termination of fire department. So if they had 20 years on with us, they started new with the Cloquet Area Fire District. So those that did join on 1-1 of 18, they now have basically 15 months of service with them. So it's completely separate.
Okay, Representative O'Driscoll.
And thank you, Madam Chair. My third and final question at this point, Mr. Farrell, you are representing the township, and I get that, and it sounds like you have an agreement with folks. Do you have the firefighters agreeing to this as well? In other words, you're saying the township is comfortable with this. Have the firefighters given their blessing or their endorsement to the liquidation plan as you're presenting it here to us today?
Good question. And all but one has been in agreement. When I first spoke to him, he was in agreement until he saw what the payouts were. He wanted it left the way it was with the vesting over 5 years and that sliding scale based on how many years of service you put in. At the same sense, he thanked me for taking this on and to get it resolved to get them paid out. Other members of our township are active members of the departments, and they are fully in support. Really, it was only the one individual that wasn't happy.
And Madam Chair, just one quick follow-up. You said you had one holdout, if you will, or one person who was questioning that. How big is the department, just to put that into perspective for us?
Mr. Farrell.
When we ended service, I think we had four members. Currently, there is around 14, I think, that would qualify to get a pension in that ballpark, give or take two or three. I'd have to count.
I was just going to say, because math can be a fun thing. If there's two people and one is a whole, so that's 50%, depending upon how you report it. So that helps put clarity on it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Doug Anderson, Executive Director of PARA. PARA does not oppose this bill as drafted because we understand there is a sense of urgency for the parties that have reached agreement. What we would like to do is have these results reviewed with our PARA SVF Advisory Board this coming summer, not as they relate to Breviter in this case, but as it may relate to plans in the future. Our advisory board consists of 10 members. They represent townships, cities, fire chiefs, volunteer firefighters, and the Office of the State Auditor. Their purpose is to provide advice to the para trustees about retirement coverage needs for volunteer firefighters in the various 160 or so departments that participate in the SVF. In the next week or two, you'll hear from our advisory board on their recommendations. They have five other recommendations, so you get to hear a little bit about what kind of work that they do. And again, we just want to have this run by them to see if they have any other ideas. Our only other comment relates to, you know, para staff did get a chance to look at the amendment and see how the distribution of benefits is done. This would be something that para staff would support or recommend to the advisory board about this procedure. It evaluates the present value of accrued benefits for all of the members, looks at the present value of accrued benefits in total, and provides a proportionate share. This is a common approach in the private sector. I've done hundreds of terminations there, seen this happen quite a bit. So it's pretty consistent with that practice, and it seems to make as much sense as any other approach here. So again, we do not oppose the bill as drafted. Want to see our advisory board get a chance to chime in on this in the summer, and appreciate the opportunity to provide those comments today.
And Mr. Anderson, you're recommending that we do not adopt the amendment at this time?
No, we're not opposing the bill. We're promoting the amendment or supporting the amendment, yes.
Okay. So that being the case, Senator Pappas moves that we adopt Amendment 1A to 2310. Any further discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Okay. Mr. Farrell, does Brevard Township have any other employees? Or are any other employees that are...
No.
Are there any other individuals employed by Brevard Township that belong to PERA?
Madam Chair, I would have to say no. All of our work is contracted out other than us elected officials. We are, I'm not sure if all three of us, I know two of the three are part of the defined contribution as an elected official. That would be it under the, and I don't know if you would consider us employees or not as an elected official. We have no employees.
Okay. Mr. Farrell, I'm asking because I wanted to, because of your previous remarks that we're saying that maybe there is not going to be a Brevard Township down the road. And I was wondering what was, if there were employees that were members of PERA, what would happen to them at that time?
Oh, and Madam Chair, I understand that, yes.
I was going to ask Mr. Anderson how he was going to deal with that when that came up then. But since not, but... I can't imagine northeastern Minnesota without Brevard Township.
Madam Chair, I would be in the same boat as you. I think that's part of the reason why myself and the clerk, I'll speak for her, have stuck it out because we don't want to see it dissipate. Like volunteer fire departments, I just think it's a sign of times unless we can get, I'm going to say, the younger generation involved a little bit more into doing stuff and being active and willing to volunteer.
Thank you. I agree. So, House File 2310, Senate File 2366, as amended, I move to recommend to pass and be incorporated into the Omnibus Pension Bill. Senator or Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to go back to one comment that Mr. Anderson had made twice. He said they don't have a problem with the bill, but he wants to run it by their advisory committee. Looking at the language in here, this becomes effective the date of enactment, which is going to most likely be after the date that, or the board will meet after the date of the enactment on here. Are you looking at this as being something that might be mutually exclusive as we're working from some of the conversations you've been involved with and looking at the different working groups to try to get a more global solution to this, or is this something that you think you need to have us wait until after your advisory committee were to look at this? And if we did, what would they tell us that would be a game changer that we would say, let's wait versus let's just move forward with this?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I'm not entirely sure about what our advisory board would want to consider at the time. They do want to have a schedule that they start their work in June or July of this summer and work throughout the summer, so I think they would want to be coordinating to some degree with what's happening with the other working groups. I'm not entirely sure what action that may lead to.
Madam Chair, that's the only question that I have, is if all of a sudden the advisory group comes back with something that's completely different, this bill moves it forward as though there are no, we're wheels up. And I'm for one comfortable with what I'm hearing this evening, and that's why I asked the executive director from PERA if he could give me a reason why we might want to wait on this. I'm not hearing anything specifically other than that advisory group is going to be starting to meet this summer. Misreading that in any way, or
Ms. Lucheski?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to note that there are actually 17 people here with benefits ranging from about $1,200 to about $3,600, and they won't get their benefits until this is resolved. So I think in waiting on the advisory committee that is over at PERA, we can certainly take those comments and amend this next session if there are some changes that come out of that group.
So then, Madam Chair,
O'Driscoll.
Thank you. And then Ms. Lucheski, page 4 of the bill is where I was citing the timeline for this. It says the 4.9, number 1, before the date of enactment of this, the termination date is September 30th of 2019. And that says the effective date of the bill is upon final enactment. So I don't know that. I just want to make sure that we don't unnecessarily delay this process, but still take into account any other kinds of things that we may not have seen. And I don't want to complicate the situation. I'm just asking these questions so we don't have complications down the road.
Mr. Farrell.
Madam Chair, I just would like to correct Ms. Szynczewski's mentioned $3,600 is $36,000. It's a significant amount of money that these people have been waiting on since January 1st of 2018. So that range, not $3,600.
Thank you. Any further discussion? All in favor of the motion as amended, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted, and the motion is adopted as amended.
Thank you, everyone. Madam Chair.
Representative Sundin.
My brand new Senator Rarick has treats outside the door. If you leave, you'll be passing out treats outside.
It was a treat to have Senator Rarick in front of us tonight. Thank you for coming. We don't have a house number.
No.
Okay. Number 5 on the agenda is will be Senate File 2584. Senator Rosen is the author. And Senate File 2584 is the PERA phased retirement program. It eliminates a sunset and annual renewal requirement. And that bill is in front of us as House File XXXX, which Mr. Haller doesn't like at all because it's, we don't know, we can't tell what XXXX is. So good thing we have a number on one side at least. Ms. Morris.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, Shana Morris, Communication Director at PERA. So PERA has been administering the phased retirement option program since 2009 when it was first established by the legislature. It allows general plan members to begin collecting a retirement annuity as early as age 62 and continue working in a part-time capacity with their governmental employer without the normal break in service requirements or without continuing to make employee or employer contributions. In 2009, when this was established, the policy rationale was to support participating employers who are anticipating struggles related to knowledge transfer with retiring baby boomers and with the influx of them that was to come up. And so that original policy rationale is consistent, actually, with what we've experienced over the last 10 years of our administration. When we surveyed our employers over the summer, 90% of them said that they are using it primarily to allow time to adjust to an employee's departure or to have some overlap in people in a job to allow for a transition or to train the replacement. And so when it was established 5 years ago, a sunset date, or 10 years ago, excuse me, a five-year sunset was placed on the program to ensure that there was no financial detriment to the plan. We asked for another an extension of that 5 years ago to continue to evaluate it. And so now, again, we've been administering it for 10 years. Absent action by the legislature, the program will end at the end of the fiscal year. Since 2009, when it was established, we've had about 1,100 members participate, about 400 different employers use the program. And so based upon the feedback from employers, we've concluded that the program's worthwhile to continue in some capacity. One of the initial concerns that we had and why the sunset was put in place was, again, to make sure that we didn't have a negative impact to the plan financially because early retirements can be subsidized and cost the plan money. But over the past 10 years, we've had a declining number of subsidized retirements. So the number of individuals with Rule of 90 benefits is significantly declining. Additionally, the 2018 Omnibus Retirement Bill is phasing out some of those subsidized early retirement benefits, giving us confidence going forward that this will not have a financial impact on the plan in a negative manner. And so with that, the PERA board is recommending four changes to the current language. We're recommending eliminating the sunset date and making this a permanent part of our benefit structure. We're requesting to eliminate the annual renewal process, thereby reducing the administrative work required by both PERA and public employers. We're clarifying that the normal break in service requirements that would apply generally to a retirement apply at the end of the five-year phased retirement period, and then making sure that we clarify that the continued employment must be with the same governmental subdivision only. And so with that, I can stand for questions and ask for your support.
Any questions? Ms. Morris? Mr. Carlson, the League of Cities?
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I want to thank Ms. Morris for working with us on the extension of the phased retirement option. This is an issue that came to our cities a number of years ago as they were looking, as Ms. Morris indicated, at a growing number of retirees and looking for ways to make sure we have a structured way to transfer knowledge to the new employees that may be coming in. Some of our cities have also found that this is a very important way to find replacements for some very technical jobs where we have very low unemployment, and this gives us a little bit more time to find the right person to fill in jobs like engineering, finance, public works types of positions. So it's been very helpful in that respect as well. This also allows a city to basically, when they have a project in progress, to allow that progress or that project to be ended in a timely and efficient manner with keeping that staff member on during the pro time period. So with that, we are very comfortable and support the repeal of the sunset. Madam Chair, I am so sorry. I forgot to mention that I'm testifying on behalf of Mr. Matt Hilgard from the Association of Minnesota counties as well. He wanted me to make sure that we echo that AMC also supports this legislation. So we do support the repeal of the sunset and the elimination of the annual renewal process, and we are very comfortable with the clarification in the break in service requirement at the end of the PRO and limiting PRO to the same government employer that the individual worked with. So we do support the legislation and would encourage you to include it in the omnibus pension bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Mr. Keith Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Keith Carlson. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Intercounty Association, and I also thought I was speaking on behalf of AMC. But, nevertheless, we do support this legislation. We particularly appreciate the streamlining that would occur under this that would eliminate the annual renewal for the PRO program that is required under the law that's expiring. As was indicated by Ms. Morris, this has been a tool that's been used by our employers to facilitate the retention of employees to permit the transfer of knowledge to their successors, and has been particularly important as our baby boom generation employees have been retiring and will continue to retire for the next several years. So we do endorse this bill and would appreciate its enactment.
Any further discussion?
Madam Chair?
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, Ms. Morris, is there any cost involved with this for PARA? I'm asking for a friend.
Ms. Morris?
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, the cost administratively is low, so that there's that perspective. The number of participants that we've had, it's about 100 per year, so that's low. But from a overall funding perspective, because we're making progress towards eliminating the subsidies that are included in early retirement just by virtue of time that's passed since 1989 and the rule of 90, and then by the bill last year, we don't anticipate any financial detriment to the plan, which is why we're comfortable eliminating the sunset. Otherwise, you'd come back. We'd be coming back asking for the sunset again.
Seeing no further discussion, commission members, in your packet is the document 19-4692, and that bill, that document is what Senate file 2584 will look like tomorrow. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I would move that document number 19-4692 be recommended to pass and be incorporated into the omnibus bill.
Is there any further discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
The motion is adopted. I heard everyone say aye. Number six on the agenda, Representative Freiberg, Senator Jasinski. House File 2598, Senate File 2490. Please begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 2490 addresses the 2011 merger issue when the Minnesota Police and Fire Relief Association merged with the PERA Police and Fire. As you know, when an interest rate assumption is changed, we need to look by statute to see how that affects the plan. Over this time, the payment has changed from about $13 million to $1 million. So over this summer, there was a work group put together, and between the PERA and the City of Minneapolis, they came up with a plan that would make a fixed payment amount from July of 2019 through July of 2031. This makes the fund whole. And that's the summary of the bill. With that, I would turn to Representative or Mr. Doug Anderson from the Executive Director of PERA to explain the bill further.
Okay. Representative Freiberg?
I agree.
Okay. Mr. Anderson, followed by Mark Ruff, followed by Brian Rice.
Sorry. That's okay.
Mr. Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, I'm Doug Anderson, Executive Director of PARA. And I can give a little bit more of the background about how we got to this point. Just first off, PARA supports this bill. We think it's a great collaboration with the City of Minneapolis, and it gives us a better approach of fulfilling these obligations to these members in a more certain way in the future. As Senator Jasinski mentioned, this was a result of a merger back in 2011. These relief associations actually go back well over 100 years that they existed in Minneapolis. They were closed to new members around 1990, so new police and fire members went directly into the PARA Police and Fire Plan at that time, and these relief association plans were closed to new members. So when they merged in with PARA in 2011, they consisted primarily of retirees. And currently there's about 600 remaining retirees from the Police Relief Association, about 400 retirees in the Fire Relief Association. Their average age is about 78 in each of the relief associations. So when the merger occurred, neither association was fully funded, so there's about $110 million unfunded liability. A full funding target date of 2031 was set, and an annual contribution commenced. And what was a little different, though, with this annual contribution was that there was put into the statutes that the contribution would change if the investment return assumption changed. So it has changed a few times over the years in 2012, 2015, and 2018. And so what we knew at the time was it was clear when a recalculation would occur, but it wasn't always really clear how it should occur, how the calculation would work. And so working closely with the City of Minneapolis, digging into the details a little bit, it now, this past summer, became more clear not just when to recalculate, but how to recalculate. And the problem with that is that neither PARA nor Minneapolis likes the approach once we understand it. So it's going to result in, you know, as the statute reads, is that if the investment return assumption changes again before 2031, there'll be a recalculation. And this recalculation means there could be a great amount of volatility in that contribution amount. And so from PARA's perspective, what PARA wanted in 2011 and what they still want today is to be made whole. They want a fair contribution so that they end up being in the same place they would have without the merger. And what Minneapolis wants, our understanding, is that they want to contribute their fair amount, but they also want a fixed level contribution, so it's easier for their budgeting and planning. And the current approach, the statute left alone as is, wouldn't accomplish that because we wouldn't really know when or how that, how much that contribution could change. But we do have a proposed solution, and the proposed solution was something that we looked at from the perspective of if PARA was going to assume all the investment risk and the mortality risk and the administrative obligation to make these payments. What is a fair price to pay for Minneapolis to pay the premium for them to have a fixed contribution going forward? So what we looked at was some information we received from our actuary back in the fall, and it influenced how we would value the liability. And specifically, we looked at what is the right discount rate that would provide PARA some assurance of coming out whole or maybe better than whole and resulting in a fixed contribution. And so from that information from our actuary, we kind of focused in on a rate. They identified a 5.85% as a good rate to use to value the liability. This provides the PARA stakeholders a 60% likelihood of the fund earning at least that, meaning a 60% likelihood that in the long run, PARA would come out ahead on this deal. So we think that was a pretty good from PARA's perspective, and I believe we think that Minneapolis was agreeable to that. So overall, we think this is a good approach. It would put the issue of any further recalculations to rest. We would know certain amounts between now and 2031, and we would feel comfortable that and our overall stakeholders would be coming out ahead on this deal. And when I talk about stakeholders, I'm talking about all stakeholders, the members, contributing members, and all the other employers. And a reminder that Minneapolis is 20% of that group, too. So in a way, they're on both sides of this deal, that they're in the group of stakeholders that are also going to, we believe, benefit in the long run from this, aside from the SEDETI contribution.
How interesting. Any questions? Mr. Ruff.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, my name is Mark Ruff. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the City of Minneapolis. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before the Commission today on behalf of Mayor Frey and our elected officials. We appreciate the consideration. We are supportive of this bill. We are grateful for Mr. Anderson's numerous hours he's invested with us to understand the history and the options, and it's a reasonable compromise from our standpoint. So I'd be happy to answer questions, Madam Chair, but that's the extent of our statement.
Seeing no questions, thank you. Mr. Rice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Brian Rice, and I'm here this evening representing the Minnesota Police Fraternal Association. That's a group of about 850 members of the PRA Police and Fire Plan who are service pensioners or their surviving spouses. About almost all of the 600 members that Mr. Anderson referenced were members of the old Minneapolis Police Relief Association. But we do have another 200 to 300 that are retired from other departments around the state, probably 30 other departments. I was involved in this legislation in 2011, the consolidation of the two plans, the Minneapolis Police Relief Association and the Minneapolis Fire Relief Association, as their general counsel. Mr. Anderson is right. These plans go back to the 1870s. Originally, and they were closed in 1980 to new members. So it's quite an older group. And let's just say in the period of time I represented associations, there was always a healthy tension between the City of Minneapolis and these plans about making sure that the obligations were paid. And the Police Fraternal Association does support this legislation. We think it's reasonable and fair to our members and to all the other members of the state. And, in fact, we think it's very important. Without this legislation, it's likely the city's levy would go from $13.5 million down to $1.5 million, a drop of $12 million. And that would be quite significant to the plan. Right now, the PRA Police and Fire Plan has a sufficiency of contribution of about 2.5%. And this contribution that the city is making would be almost half of that number. So it's very important, and in the presentations to the government finance committees earlier this year, PARA broke that contribution out by the city, and it's very significant. So having the city come up and be willing to make that $7.5 million contribution, that's about 0.8% of payroll, and that's a big number. When we worked on the pension bill the last 3 years, there were long debates over what 0.1% of payroll would mean in terms of coverage. So this is an important element, I think, to keep the PRA Police and Fire Plan stable. I also think it represents some really good work by Mr. Anderson to go through and work through this issue. And I would say by the City of Minneapolis, too, Mr. Ruff, I would say 10 years ago, if Minneapolis were given the opportunity of getting a huge reduction in their pension liability, the city finance director would probably take the money and run. But what we're finding out is that these, as the state did in the bill you passed last year, how governments show up in the credit markets is really important. And if there's a chance that you're going to be exposed to pension liabilities in the future, the rating agencies would downgrade your credit because of that. And so what the city is getting out of this deal is certainty in their payments, so they can go to their creditors and say, here's our obligation, we're paying it off. I do think it was, I really applaud Mr. Anderson and Mr. Ruff, the city, for coming up with something that's reasonable. Our group, the board of directors, looked at this very closely. Quite frankly, they were a bit skeptical about the city. They thought, well, is the city getting away with anything? And actually, I would say they're not. We heard Mr. Mansco Perry talk about not touching the assumed rate of return for at least another 5 years. We went through that exercise. So if you were the city, you could say the rate under current law, the city's calculation wouldn't change for at least another 5 years. And that gets us closer to 2031. And I think the certainty of what the city has come up with and what PARA is long-term, I think it's way more likely than not that PARA is going to come out ahead on this deal, which means the retirees will have a more secure pension. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
You're welcome. Are there any questions? Any comments? Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd move that House File 2598, Senate File 2490 be recommended to be incorporated into the omnibus bill.
Any further discussion? All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Thank you.
Turning the page, number 7, Representative Detmer, Senator Anderson.
Oh, I thought I saw it first here.
Representative Detmer.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Good evening.
Please present.
We have House File 549 and Senate File 1444. And this is something that I started working on last summer. We had people over the summer. We got together with, Susan Leszewski and my staff, Brian Cook, and we took a good look at what was happening here, because I got some information from a friend of mine that I served in the military. Speaking today is also Randy Beeble, and we served together, and I had lost contact with him until I got an email from him and asking if we could put together a piece of legislation for those military who have served prior to working in, say, in the police or fire department, to be able to buy back some of the years that they had served. Myself, I taught for 34 years, and I was deployed for 2 years after 9/11, and I was able to take buy back days for TRA, so I could retire under the rule of 90. And so I start seriously looking at this, and let's see what we can do. So we sat down, take a look, because the PARA used to have that option to buy back after they, say, got hired, and they had service prior to that. They were able to buy back some years, but it sunsetted, I think, in 2013. So we put together some legislation, and I think we solved that issue, allowing service members, men and women, to purchase buy back up to 5 years. So with that, if Senator has some comments, and then I'd like to have Randy Beeble speak, too.
Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, I've learned my P's and Q's from being in the military. I am just an NCO, and I have an officer sitting to my right, so I totally agree.
Okay.
Make sure you say warrant officer.
Chief warrant officer.
Mr. Beeble.
Madam Chair, Commission members, thank you for allowing me to speak tonight. I'm speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters as well as myself. I've been a firefighter for the last 17 years, and I've been deployed five times. I've been deployed to Afghanistan, Iraq, Gitmo, as well as in another immediate war zone. Closer to home, right after 9/11, I was deployed to D.C., working at the FBI building. I have purchased back my military buyback before when I was deployed, but I've never had the opportunity or the availability to buy back just my initial enlistment because of the windows. They've always been in windows. So I worked with the representative to try to get this permit. They made it permanent for the teachers back in 2013, and I'm not sure why we just allowed our provision to expire. And we tried to work with the executive director, with PARA, and address their concerns. So we met in January as well as most recently. So we addressed the five-year cap thing. And we also addressed, normally you wouldn't buy this until you were vested. But since our vesting period now for PARA is up to 20 years, that didn't make sense. So we looked at being 5 years on the job. And that made sense to us. Most military veterans now come on later on the job. We have veterans that get hired after age 40. That includes the police. Last week you heard in this committee about recruiting issues for police and fire. That has absolutely been the case. It is true, and this could be a recruiting tool for us. We have a list that was just established. We normally have 1,500 people apply, have a list around 900, but this current list is 457. And if you read anything about the St. Paul Police, their recent hire, they had to reopen their list three times. We're having a lot of problems recruiting. So we think it also could be a recruiting tool. And PARA for itself, police and fire do not get Social Security. We're not covered by the Social Security provision. And any Social Security we may have earned, we're covered by what's called the WEP provision, the Windfall Elimination Provision. So we only get 40% of whatever we're entitled to. So even if you got your qualifying quarters, say $1,000, you get $400. So this is our opportunity to invest in one of our investment tools or one of our options to explore and make up for times that we served. And with that, I appreciate the ability to testify, and we'll take any questions.
Mr. Rice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian Rice for the Minnesota Professional Firefighters. I'm not Chris Parsons. He was listed. He's about a foot taller than me. But I did want to convey that we have worked with Mr. Bebo, Representative Detmer, Senator Anderson on this issue there. Firefighters are fully in support of it. Mr. Parsons said that he's contacted Mr. Flaherty, who's also indicated that the MPPOA would be in support of it. I think that Randy has really capsulized that. A big part of this is vesting. The number of veterans are coming. They're coming as a second career, and it's tougher to find personnel in the public safety area. I think that's become a theme that we've heard. Two last points. Randy is right. This 20-year vesting, which was passed in 2014, is probably an issue that this pension commission is going to have to review sometime in the future. We're not asking you to look at it this session, but that was done in 2014 to deal with the funding problems PRA Police and Fire was facing at the time. We know that the bill you passed last year really helped the plan recover, but I think it's going to be an issue that I think in the future you're going to have to look at. And this is one way to address that, to make this still an attractive career for former military members so they can at least get credit for their past service. And again, there's a 1A amendment. PRA had a number of concerns about the bill initially. Mr. Anderson's here. He can speak for himself. They were administrative in nature, I'd say. We did sit down with Mr. Anderson and work through a number of these things, and we would be supportive of that amendment to address some of their concerns. And I know Susan has been met with on this too, and she'll offer an explanation. We think all of those are reasonable attempts to make this, you know, practical and reasonable with the association. And maybe rather than me explain, she could do that as well.
Yeah, Madam Chair, the 1A amendment.
Representative Detmer.
Yes, Madam Chair, the 1A amendment, of course, this was the first time I was dealing with any legislation with PARA, and we put together the first bill, and then all of a sudden I found about five people in my office, and along with Susan and Mr. Anderson and several other people, and it was a eye-opening experience to listen to some concerns, and I said, well, let's put together an amendment and see what we can work out, and I'm really impressed by the work that they were able to do, and I think we have a good bill coming forward as amended.
Okay.
Do we have to,
Madam Chair? Do I understand this right now? You're asking for someone that served in the military before they were hired by the state or the county or the city and became a member of PERA. You're asking that the legislation be allowed them to buy back their 5 years of previous service before they worked for the state or the county or the city.
Correct? That's correct, Madam Chair. And that was in statute before, but it was sunsetted in 2013, I believe.
Yes.
And Mr. Bebo, there are evidently you work with people that worked before they were firefighters before 2013.
And yes, Madam Chair.
They had served up to 5 years.
Yes, normally 2 to 4.
They
or something.
They didn't apply to.
They didn't meet the vesting period because the vesting period kept changing. The vesting period went to 5 to 10 to 15, and now it's to 20. So at the same time the window was expiring, the vesting period was sliding. I don't know how to say that better.
Upwards.
Okay.
Upwards?
Upwards.
But that
vesting is, it's offered at several states, and the feds do this normally.
Why did you pick up to 5 years?
We were working with the PARA, picked that number, and it made sense.
Okay. It was a compromise, Madam Chair.
Compromise.
Yeah.
What were you after, Representative Detmer?
Well, I think there was not a limit before, but we agree that 5 years would be a good year to compromise with. And it's not exactly a cheap thing to do. It's expensive to buy back those.
Because you have to pay with interest.
Right.
Full actuarial value.
Yeah. Senator Frentz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. And thank you, Senator Anderson, again. Great bill. Glad to support it. Also worth noting that these candidates that we're incentivizing are to help us recruit, these are some of the best candidates, right?
That's correct.
Veterans are particularly well-suited to do this work. So we're not just helping with recruiting. We're also hopefully raising the quality of the people and glad to support it.
Women veterans, too, now.
Sure. Yeah. That's a group we want to recruit from, and we should always want to make it more attractive, especially when we're finding difficulty recruiting. So thank you.
Yeah.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Lincheski, could you just give us an example of, how this might work?
Ms. Lincheski.
Be clear. Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, my understanding is that someone would begin working in public service, start, say, at a municipality. They would then begin to accrue service under PARA. They have this pre-employment service in the military. They would then be able to apply to PARA to purchase that service, in quotes. So what they would have to pay is the present value of the increase in the benefit when the service is added in as compared to the benefit without the service. So that difference would then be sort of determined as a, say, age 65 benefit worked back to the present value and that's what they would be required to pay.
Senator Pappas.
So, Madam Chair, this is not if you're a PERA employee and then you break employment to go in the military, then you come back. This is for military service before you were an employee. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, it applies in two situations.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
One is the one you're talking about, okay. So pre-employment military service. Mm-hmm. The other situation is where the person has sort of blown through the deadlines that would give them the opportunity to buy back service for military service that they left public employment to go serve. So there are deadlines, and those are driven by federal law, and our state laws just sort of duplicate those. They have some timing, some deadlines on when you have to come in and purchase that service, and if you fail to hit those deadlines, then you are able to do it under this other process.
Okay. And then just one more question, Madam Chair. So when we talk about full actuarial, whatever that word is, actuarial value, is that almost like they're paying both the employee and the employer part of the payment? Is that what that means? So the employer is not paying, in other words, just the employee is kind of double paying.
Right. Yes.
To buy it back.
Madam Chair, Senator
Ms.
Pappas.
Lancheski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Pappas. So under the USERRA or the federally protected, the employee comes back and is required to pay just the employee contributions that would have been paid during the period had he or she been employed, without interest. So it's just the employee contributions. Under the other method, where it's the pre-employment military service, that is actually the greater of two options. One is this actuarial equivalency value. The other is, if it happens to be more, all employee contributions, employer contributions, together with interest from the time that they would have contributed those amounts. So whichever is the greater of, that's what the required payment is.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Anderson.
And Madam Chair, as Mr. Anderson is coming up here, I think we need to all realize that there's a lot of skill sets that our men and women that are serving in the military that transfers very well into other civilian jobs like police and fire, because those military branches of service have those military police, firefighters, and so forth. So it's a good way to welcome them back into Minnesota to get good-paying jobs. So,
Mr. Anderson, do you have something to contribute to this discussion?
Madam Chair, yes, I do. Thank you for the opportunity. Appreciate being here and able to speak on this issue. PERA is not opposed to this bill because we do understand the desire to offer this feature to military veterans, and we do appreciate the efforts in the amendment to help address some of our concerns. We do have a few comments on three different issues I'd like to get on the record. First is just related to administrative costs. We did, as mentioned before, this was part of the plan back prior to 2013, so we have some experience understanding what the administrative costs are. This will require us to update our communication materials, provide individual benefit estimates, and engage with our actuaries whenever an election is made for the final pricing of the product. You know, we know back from prior to 2013, we used to get about 50 to 60 inquiries per year, estimate about 5 to 6 hours of staff time per inquiry. So it's about 250 to 300 hours of staff time. So we wouldn't necessarily have to staff up for this, but it would change priorities. So if they have to work on these, they would prioritize these requests. It delays any other calculations that they work on. And these are administrative costs that are borne by all the stakeholders. The cost is not incorporated into the cost of the purchase. And, of course, if in the future, if there's more inquiries or more effort or options to elect this, we would see those costs rise in the future. The second issue I'd like to talk about is just the low election rates that we've seen. For whatever reason, people just do not like to purchase annuities. They're costly. And paying the full actuarial cost can be rather high, and I think for a lot of individuals, they look at that and choose to pass. So, you know, what we've seen from historical election rates for us is that we would get 50, 60 inquiries per year, get maybe one, maybe two per year that make the election. We also contacted the Teachers Retirement Association, who currently has this provision. Since May of 2011, they've performed 93 calculations with one person making that purchase. So overall, this is an election rate of not more than 3%. And we recognize this is going back a bit. Maybe circumstances may change. Maybe there'll be more elections of this. Maybe vesting, we've talked about that a few times in different contexts. Maybe that is an issue where we might see this change, but I just wanted to note that overall, we put in a fair amount of effort for people that are interested, but very few who actually elect to take the option. And the third issue I'd like to talk about is just the actuarial equivalence component. And again, we've established that this would be the member paying the full actuarial cost of the benefit. So in theory, that would say there's no cost to the plan. There is cost to the plan because of the administration, but there's also the opportunity, because of the way actuarial equivalence is defined, it's a bit limited, because actuarial equivalence in the statute is only based on a couple of variables. One is the investment return assumption. One is the mortality rates, and the other is that it assumes the member takes retirement at their normal retirement age. It doesn't consider the potential for early retirement, disability, termination, benefit election choices, nor does it capture any future assumption changes, COLA changes, or anything else that may change in the future. And there's really no way to capture in the cost the advantage that a member may have who knows their individual situation about their health or their retirement. So it tends to be a little bit more favorable towards a member who's looking at this option, which means it's a little less favorable for the other stakeholders involved. Again, because of the election rates, we don't view this as a significant cost, but it is a little bit of a concern about actual equivalence. And we did ask for one of the changes we asked for in the amendment that wasn't the amendment that we do appreciate was that it's a different way of calculating actual equivalence. It does incorporate one of those factors that previously was excluded. It's the factor of what if a member retires early. And so recognizing that if someone is seeking this benefit, they may be trying to maximize their retirement benefit, all we were asking for is that the actual equivalence cost is based on the most favorable retirement age, not the normal retirement age. But if there are early retirement subsidies, that we value that as well in the cost, and that was in the amendment, and we think that's a good change that is helpful for the plan. So in conclusion, again, we recognize that the policy of providing this feature is attractive. We reiterate that PARA does not oppose the bill. What PARA will want to do prospectively, since we try to be efficient with our work effort, is to just track the amount of interest, the amount of inquiries, the amount of elections that are taken up. We think it might be interesting to see what happens here. It might shed some light for our employers about what kind of recruiting or retention issues they may have. It might shed some light on vesting and what that may mean. But if there ultimately is going to be very low elections and a lot of administrative cost, we may ask the board to look at this sometime in the future to see if it's really balancing benefits and costs. But thank you for the opportunity to provide comments, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Mr. Anderson, does this, if this was enacted and somebody bought back 5 years, up to 5 years, would that change the amount of money of their pension? Because of the length of service, would that?
Well, Madam Chair, because they'd be paying the actuarial equivalent or the full cost, what we would see for the plan, for the member, what they would experience would be a benefit that's based on 5 more years of service, so they'd have a larger benefit. It would create a liability in the plan that's larger, but we'd also see an equivalent size asset coming into the plan to offset that cost. So from generally, we'd see something close to actuarial equivalent coming in to the plan, an equal amount of liability increase, an equal amount of asset increase.
Okay.
What we don't really know is over time how accurate that liability estimate really is. That's going to vary from case to case.
And Mr. Anderson, going on that same analogy, would we keep that employee as long as we do now without the ability to buy back? Would the employee that comes in and could buy back 5 years stay 5 years less, working for the state or the city or the county or the township or the school district?
Madam Chair, that's a good question. I think it would just vary on a case-by-case basis. I would imagine that some members would buy the service and continue to work on to their early or normal retirement age, and I would imagine that some would use it to advance the ability to retire early.
Mr. Bebo, you've been talking to more people about this than anybody, I bet, and I bet you've studied that for a long time. When the people say, yes, we should have this, are they talking about it so that they can buy the years and then get out sooner?
Madam Chair, Commission members, yes, they're talking about getting up to their 25 but not getting out sooner for the penalty. Early retirement penalty is huge for us between 50 and 55. It's like 5% a year. So nobody's talking about early retirement, whether it's fire or police. So, and then we're forced out at 65. So everybody's trying to get above that 55 magic number, and then you're working it. So there's nobody looking to get out early. They're just trying to get more time in service credit, per se. So nobody's retiring early based on that. It just doesn't work out that way. You wish it would. But people get on later on the job. We're hiring people over 40. So if you're trying to get your 20, you know, this is applying towards vesting. So if you get in over 40, yeah, maybe then you're going to get out before 65.
And Representative Detmer, I can't help but think that you're saying that this could be a carrot on the stick and
for people that are 30.
Recruiting thing, but
most men and Madam Chair, most
if we're
men
not
women,
going to get to keep them as long as we are, and our workforce is declining in this kind of thing, is this a prudent thing for the commission to do?
Well, if you look at Madam Chair, most men and women, if they're going to retire from the military, you got to have 20 good years to or medically retire. But Mr. Bebo mentioned here is that they're hiring people that are in their 30s and 40s to join the police force or the fire department. And so this is an incentive to bring those type of people with those skill sets into the service, civilian service.
I understand that. But the other side. Representative Rice, or Mr. Rice.
Thank you. Thank you for the compliment, Madam Chair. I think a couple things. You know, the commission really extended vesting. When you cut back on early retirement in the 14 bill, the penalty to retire early is great. So it wouldn't make sense for someone to buy back 5 years at full value and then retire before 55 and pay a penalty for retiring early. You could do that, but it wouldn't be financially prudent. Secondly, this employment, we are at full employment. We're going to have to keep people working as long as we can. You just passed a bill for the PRA and the League of Counties and Cities to keep the really talented workforce working. They can go at 62, but you're going to hire them back and keep them on the job because they're really specialized talent, and they tend to be the city administrators and the white-collar people and computer guys and even some exceptionally good lobbyists that you want to keep around in the talent pool because they know a lot, and it's really valuable to do that. And is this a little bit different? Kind of, but it's in a field that, let's say if somebody who works to 40 in the military and they're looking at a second career and they want to be able to maximize that, they're going to lose Social Security by joining police and fire. I mean, the penalty is quite real for anybody who's done that, that if you thought you were going to cash in on this business and not be in a coordinated plan like legislators like Senator Limmer, forget about it. You're going to really pay a penalty to do that work, because you're any money you get in an uncoordinated plan, you're going to lose a big chunk of your Social Security. And could there be some selectivity stuff? Possibly, but it's really more of an option to make this job maybe just a bit more attractive for somebody who had prior military service who could buy back and, you know, work as a firefighter until they're 60 or 65 or a police officer.
And Madam Chair, I know that I think in the education field as teachers, we see a lot of people who have served in the military are also in the careers in education. So this is a benefit that they have already, and it didn't sunset for them. So,
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Mr. Anderson, the word vested versus eligible for a pension. So to be PERA covered, you have to be in employment for at least 5 years to be eligible for benefits, for a pension benefit, correct?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I'm not entirely sure because it's changed for periods of, depending on some higher dates. So I believe that for those that are hired after 2013, I'm looking for audience, 2014, that's when the vesting requirements changed, became later, and the vesting in that instance starts at 10 years, 50% after 10 years and grades up after that. So prior to that time, I'm not quite sure.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Anderson, I just wanted to kind of build a scenario here. So let's say that we have an individual who enters the Selective Services, has been in the Selective Services for 5 years, and let's assume they went at 18, now they're out at 23. So that individual then goes to work in PERA-covered service for 10 years, which makes them 33, and they decide that they want to leave. They could buy those 5 years of military service to count toward their PERA pension and still defer that benefit until normal retirement age, correct?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, yes, that's my understanding that that's correct.
Representative O'Driscoll.
And Mr. Anderson, the full actuarial value or the cost to that individual is going to be substantially less at that point in time than it would be if they were on the backside of a career facing retirement, am I correct?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, yes, the actuarial equivalent value is less for those earlier or further removed from retirement, those earlier in their career, than it is for someone who's closer to retirement. So part of the actuarial adjustment is a discounting for the value of time at 7.5%.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so, Mr. Anderson, you had stated earlier that you maybe get 80 or 90 inquiries. You may have one or two or three people have taken advantage of this. Given how competitive the marketplace is right now for qualified employees and what we've heard from testimony from people here today, I'm wondering, and again, we probably don't have the answer, and it's purely speculation, but I'm wondering if there isn't going to be a number of people who, when charting out a career path for themselves, might choose to do something like that, work for 10 years at age 33, age 34, get out of public service knowing that they've got 15 years that they can put in and at a relatively modest amount of money for those 5 years from the service, relatively speaking, go and do something else. And I don't know that that necessarily increases the number of people that we would be retaining in the business or in these critical areas. Again, maybe it's rhetorical in nature, but I do have some concerns about that. Second area of questions that I have, Madam Chair, is let's start out again with an individual who's 18 that goes into Selective Services, and they retire from Selective Services after a 25 or 30-year career, and they're eligible for a military pension. Then they would be then they take on PERA-covered employment. They would need to have 10 years. So let's just use 25 years. I'll make it easy, 20 years. 18 plus 20 is 38, and then you've got an individual for 10 years, so they're 48. They wanted to buy an additional 5 years. They've already used those 20 or 25 years to qualify for a military benefit. would we be allowing them to, in essence, double up on those in Minnesota's PERA program, even though those years were used toward a qualified pension from the Selective Services?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, yes, it's my understanding that there's the limit is 5 years what you could purchase. I don't believe there's any test to say whether or not there was any other retirement coverage for that 5 years that occurred. So you, a person could buy regardless of what other coverage they had.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Anderson. Another set of questions. TRA has a provision that is equivalent to what we're looking at being proposed tonight for PERA, where they can have service. I understand when you're an employee and the service break to be able to cover that. That makes perfectly good sense. Do we also have that provision in TRA, to the best of your knowledge, for individuals to be able to buy service up to 5 years?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll. It's my understanding that TRA has the same provision. There are the amendment here, and then there are some differences in this bill and the amendment that would make there be some differences. But yes, TRA does allow for pre public service military service purchases. Is my understanding.
Mr. Beeble.
Madam Chair, TRA does not have a cap either. So they don't have a cap. They don't have a five-year cap.
Not 5 years?
They don't have a cap on their provision either. That went into permitted statute back in 2013.
Mr. Stoffel.
Welcome. Madam Chair, Jay Stoffel, Executive Director of TRA.
You didn't jump up. You kind of answered my plea.
Yes. I saw I got the eyes.
Yes.
On the question of the cap, the TRA provision provides for the initial period of induction or enlistment. So whatever that initial period is, that may vary by service, but it's just for the initial period of military enlistment or induction. That's our cap.
And what do you mean by that?
That's how much military service a person could purchase. It's for the initial enlistment period or induction period, if that's 3 or 4 years or 5 years. I'm not familiar with the length of those inductment periods, but we do have a cap, Madam Chair.
So it might just be 2 years.
Yes, Madam Chair, yes.
And Madam Chair, that would be the enlistment period would be a 6 year plus two in the ready reserve, so it would be up to 8 years.
8 year contract. Okay.
Yeah. And Mr. Stoffel, they don't have to be employed as a teacher and a member of TRA and go off to military service. They can, if they had it before they got their degree and became a teacher, that would be fine to buy back.
Madam Chair, yes, we actually have two things. We have for people who are currently teachers, educators, working in the field of education, they may take a military leave, and under that provision, they can buy that service. What we're talking about, the bill before you today, is for the provision that we currently have. It wasn't sunsetted. It's for a period of military service before becoming a teacher, and we have the authority to allow people to pay for that time before they became a teacher or an educator in Minnesota.
Do they pay at that price, or do they pay at today's price?
They pay either, it's the higher of the contributions that would have been made, or plus interest, or the full actuarial value, which yes, Madam Chair, I was just looking at a list of numbers. We've had 35 of these calculations in the last 4 years, and we've only had one person make the purchase. Just a rough rule of thumb, as I was looking over the list of the 35 calculations, each year of service, each 1 year of service, roughly $30,000 per the 1 year of service. That's to give you a sense of the cost in our experience.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll.
Madam Chair, just a couple of more general questions, and then if we could also hear from MSRS to see how they are handling this, because we do have State Patrol covered individuals, and they're experiencing the same kinds of issues that were being discussed with PNF under PERA. Madam Chair, one other question that I have, and maybe since Mr. Stoffel is nearby, he can help with how this might work under TRA. So I'm an employee in the St. Paul School District. I've been here for 7 years. I get called to active duty. I'm gone for a year. I know that during the break of service, I'm eligible for benefits to be able to be paid to be continued. That 1 year that I'm gone, can I also use that as 1 year of military service that I could buy back, in essence being one, and then getting the layering of that for the same amount of time by paying an additional fee for that year that I was on active service, even though my Minnesota pension was being covered during my absence?
No. Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I'm not sure if I quite followed all of that, but maybe is this a question related to the dual coverage?
Well, Madam Chair, it's really not a question related to the dual coverage as much as it is if I'm deployed from January 1st, 2019 through December 31st of 2019, yeah. I'm covered under the Leave Act,
yes.
Right now.
Yeah. That's right.
But am I asking, can I use that 1 year of time to also be a year of service credit for the Selective Services, yeah, to be able to buy one more year when, in essence, it's only one calendar year, but can I get 2 years worth of credit out of that?
No.
Mr. Stoffel.
Madam Chair, I guess that's the situation that I was in, Representative O'Driscoll. After 9/11, I was called up for almost 2 years. And that time, when you're called up, you're everything with your teaching job, that all those benefits stop. Okay, everything stopped. Your salary, everything stopped. So now I'm serving in the military. And when I came back after I was released, then I decided to buy back those months that I missed. So the school district paid in their share, and then I paid my share in. That's how that works.
Representative O'Driscoll.
And then Representative Detmer, to the next level. Would you also be eligible then to take those years that you were out on 9/11 to be able to use those as prior military service credits under what we're talking about now to be able to
what I was able, what I, Madam Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, what I was able to do then, because I was so close to the rule of 90, I was able to retire under the rule of 90. Otherwise, if I wouldn't have bought those months back, I would have had to teach for another 2 years to retire under the rule of 90.
And then, Madam Chair, the only other thing is, when it's appropriate, just to hear from MSRS. I don't want people to think by my questioning that I'm totally opposed to the idea. This is what I do around here, is I ask a lot of financial questions, a lot of what-if questions on here. And I fear that we won't be ready necessarily if all of a sudden we start getting an onslaught of people who say, well, the way that the laws are written now, I should try to take advantage of or do this. And again, we just went through a 3-year gyration of trying to stabilize everything. And I want to make sure that these kinds of things don't tip the balance that we're looking at right now. I think it can be done, but I think it needs some more work, Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas. Okay. Ms. Leonard.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, MSRS does not have the provision of prior military service buyback. It was in our laws and sunsetted. We do allow leave of absence purchases for military leaves.
Sam Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really would like to do this, and I don't want to be disrespectful to my friends and my firefighter friends, but it's discouraging to me that, you know, our experience has shown that only one or two people has used this program. We spent a lot of time discussing it tonight. With the high administrative costs involved, I think we need more evidence that our military personnel and our firefighters are actually going to use this program before we put it into law. So, Madam Chair, if you'd be willing to kind of lay this over for a few weeks so that we could do a little bit more research to see if this is really going to help people. I'll move that we lay it over.
Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm in favor of it as well, but I'd like to see actual, like, a example of numbers to get a better handle on what this is. I don't know if it's 5,000, 10,000, 30,000. To see an example of one of these people used it, what the dollar amounts they contributed and how they benefited from it would be beneficial to me. I don't know if that's available or not, or someone can use an example of those dollar amounts. That would be helpful. Maybe I'm not the only one, but.
We've had two people purchase
Senator Pappas, Representative Detmer, I'm going to accept your advice. I will lay this bill over. We'll revisit at a later time.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Number 8 is the MSRS administrative bill. Ms. Leonard should have stayed. Ms. Leonard.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members. Erin Leonard, Executive Director of MSRS. Today, we are going to talk about the MSRS Administrative Bill. Sections 1, 4, 5, 6, 10, 11, and 14 all relate to the application process for retirement. Our current retirement application process was recently reviewed. The board affirmed our current process and is requesting that these changes in these sections just to clarify the application requirements for retirement. Sections 2 and 3 clarify the eligibility of unclassified plan members to vote in MSRS elections. Current law did not specify whether unclassified members were permitted to vote in MSRS board member elections. In practice, historically, MSRS has interpreted the statute inclusively by including unclassified members in the 4 general unclassified plan board member elections. Section 7 adds clarifying language regarding the effect of repaying a refund on vesting credit. So you're all aware that when someone leaves state employment, they can take a refund of their contributions plus interest. If the member does take a refund, they forfeit their service credit for years in any service and any right to an annuity under the laws. For example, if a person who was hired before 1989, July 1, 1989, took a refund, they would lose their right to Rule of 90. If they return to state service after 6 months, they can repay any of the refunds that they've taken from MSRS. If they do, they regain those service credits and the rights they had under the laws. The law also allows them to pay this in one-third payments. So it was unclear, the law was ambiguous as to whether their full initial hire rights were restored. So by inadvertently, if a person only paid a third, they would actually get their full rights restored, although only a prorated portion of the service credit. And it created a disincentive or encouraged members to take a refund and potentially, when they return to state service, only pay for a third of that refund. We'd like to propose this language that modifies statute to require a member to pay repay the entire refund before being eligible for those initial hire date rights. Sections 8 and 9 authorize retroactive contributions when a member elects the fire marshal or military affairs of a special plan coverage. So these members are part of our general plan. However, there's a special election, so they get a slightly higher benefit. They pay slightly higher contributions, and they have a lower retirement age just because of the nature of the work. Currently, they can make this election within 90 days of their employment. And while there's no specific section authorizing MSRS to collect the past due contributions, generally our statute allows us to collect past contributions for 60 days. But because the individuals have 90 days to make the election, we can only currently collect 60 days of contributions. And we just like to make that consistent where we can collect the full 90-day period. Employees would pay their portion and the employer would pay their portion of contributions. Section 12 corrects an oversight from the omnibus pension bill last year related to the Fairview former University of Minnesota Hospital and Clinic augmentation. The changes to the augmentation rates for the former UMHC members were in the 2018 retirement bill failed to memorialize the pre-2018 augmentation rates, so we took all of those out. those rates or a reference to them must remain in statute because augmentation is calculated at the time of retirement rather than the time as when it's accrued. Section 13 adds language to 356, clarifying that the retirement systems at SBI are exempt from the minute chapter of statute. So in 2011, when Minute or Minnesota IT Services was created, the retirement systems and SBI were specifically excluded from the consolidation requirements. That's outlined in the 16E chapter for Minute. We worked with the other retirement funds, SBI, and LCPR staff to create language that could be added to our retirement chapters in 356. So this language clarifies that we are exempt from that consolidation. It also further clarifies that we may choose to use minute services if we wish. And then Section 15 deletes an obsolete section of statute. The 2018 Omnibus Retirement Bill allowed individuals who are in the Fairview Group to collect an annuity without terminating from Fairview Health Services. This section applies on earning 352F, the repealed section 0.06, applies on earnings limitations to annuitants who return to work at Fairview because they no longer have to terminate and to begin collecting an annuity. This, we no longer need the earnings limitation for these individuals.
Ms. Leonard, you're talking about document 19-4622. And that's going to be Senate File 2583 as of tomorrow. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair, members. It will be introduced tomorrow under that number. That's correct.
And Ms. Leonard, this is basically a ordinary, old-fashioned housekeeping bill.
Madam Chair, members, yes. We are hopefully going to stick with old-fashioned housekeeping bills for a little while.
Well, it's good to have a clean house.
Mm-hmm.
And your board has agreed to all of these points, and your membership, the memberships of your plans, know about this.
Madam Chair, members, yes, that's correct. These were all brought before the board.
That being said, Senator Pappas. Is there any further discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. The bill is getting fatter.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, we do have the room for a longer period of time. And people are came prepared to discuss fossil fuel investments as announced. And we would like to start with Mansco Perry, the Executive Director of State Board of Investments, who has a presentation to make about how the State Board of Investments addresses investments of this nature.
I was going to say good night, but good evening, Madam Chair, members. Tonight, my plan was to share with you the activities that the State Board of Investment engages in to be a responsible asset owner beyond seeking the best risk-adjusted returns that we can achieve. I'll address how we approach our issues related to environmental, social, and governance, better known by the acronym ESG issues. State Board of Investments are responsible for the management of various retirement funds, trust funds, and the cash accounts for the state of Minnesota. All investments undertaken by the SBI are governed by the prudent person rule and other standards codified in Minnesota statutes, Chapter 11A, which is our governing statute, and Chapter 356A, which outlines our fiduciary responsibility. In September of 2007, the board adopted a set of investment beliefs for managing the assets of the combined funds. Those are the funds utilized to support the defined benefit pension plans of state employees. The primary purpose of these beliefs is to guide the SBI towards sound investing principles related to the investing on behalf of the combined funds. In this respect, the beliefs help provide context for the SBI's actions. They reflect our investment values and acknowledge our role in supporting the state's broader retirement systems. When relevant, we also use these beliefs when investing on behalf of our other investment programs. One of these beliefs is as follows: utilizing engagement activities to address environmental, social, and governance issues can lead to positive portfolio and governance outcomes. So in addition to specific engagement strategies, the SBI might also apply proxy rights attached to our shareholder interests in public companies, as these are plan assets of the SBI and represent a key mechanism for expressing the SBI's positions relating to specific ESG issues. By taking a leadership role in promoting responsible corporate governance through proxy voting process, the SBI can contribute significantly to implementing ESG best practices, which in turn add to long-term investment value. Within the context of our fiduciary duty and our investment beliefs, a variety of issues can have negative impact on the long-term value of the SBI's portfolio. Several engagement strategies that we currently implement are our proxy voting. We participate with investor-led coalitions, and we are very supportive of investor statements. Also, one of the things that we're doing specifically for climate change is we have engaged one of our investment consultants to develop a climate change investment risk review study. So with regards to proxy voting, so in conjunction with our investment belief, the SBI authorizes a proxy committee that's responsible for voting of the board's proxy rights with respect to shares owned by U.S. publicly owned companies. By exercising our proxy rights, we hope to influence how companies address ESG issues. For instance, the SBI has previously voted to support resolutions requiring companies to conduct research on climate risk and opportunities with respect to the company's business operations. In addition, the SBI has routinely voted against unreasonable executive compensation package. These examples illustrate the importance of engagement as opposed to divestment and the SBI's ability to influence companies as a shareholder. In 2018, the SBI, as an example, voted for resolutions asking companies to perform climate change risk analysis. One company in particular, Andarco, we were successful in being part of a group that was the majority on that vote, which is something that's pretty rare in proxy voting circles. We have ESG engagement initiatives. So in addition to exercising our proxy voting rights, the SBI has partnered with several organizations to more effectively address ESG issues that can lead to positive portfolio outcomes. So brief description of each of our activities are with several organizations. One, we are an original founder and long-term member of the Council of Institutional Investors. The goal of CII is to promote strong shareholder rights and governance standards at public companies. In recent years, we signed on to several letters regarding these topics that have been addressed to the Securities and Exchange Commission and the United States Congress. The SBI staff participate in CII organized events, many conference calls to learn about what other institutions are doing in terms of engagement. These opportunities help staff be prepared for the type of proposals that need to be discussed with our proxy committee. We plan on continuing these issues going forward. We also are a signatory to the UN Principles of Responsible Investment. This organization was developed in 2005 by a group of the world's largest institutional investors in a process coordinated by UN Secretary General and McAllister College grad Kofi Annan. The mission statement goes, "We believe that an economically efficient, sustainable global financial system is a necessity for long-term value creation. Such a system will reward long-term responsible investment and benefit the environment and society as a whole. The PRI will work to achieve the sustainable global financial system by encouraging adoption of the principles and on collaborating with their implementation by fostering good governance, integrity, and accountability, and by addressing obstacles to a sustainable financial system that lie within market practices, structures, and regulation. The six principles are: one, to incorporate environmental, social, and corporate governance issues into investment analysis and decision-making processes. Two, to be an active owner and to incorporate ESG issues into our ownership policies and practices. Three, to seek appropriate disclosure on ESG issues by the entities in which we invest. Four, to promote acceptance and implementation of the principles within the investment industry. Five, to work with the PRI Secretariat and other signatories to enhance their effectiveness in implementing the principles. And six, to report our activities and progress towards implementing the principles. As a signatory in 2018, we are responsible to make a report on behalf of the SBI in 2021, I believe. 2016, we also joined the Coalition for Environmentally Responsible Economies, better known as CERES. The mission of this organization is to transform the economy to build a sustainable future for people and the planet. Some of the activities of CERES are supporting investors in their engagement activities with companies on climate and sustainability issues. We've launched the Global Reporting Initiative to improve company reporting on ESG issues. We advocate for stronger climate and clean energy policies, and we directly engage with companies to strengthen disclosure of climate change-related risks. The SBI has been supportive of many of these issues. The last organization I'll mention is the Institutional Limited Partners Association. We are limited partners with well over 100 limited partnerships. This organization has been used to promote education, research, and advocacy to ensure that general partners are transparent. And we try to emphasize to the SEC the importance of there being fiduciary duty standards to all our investment advisors. As I said before, one of the things we do is engage an investor with investors making certain statements. Recently, I won't go into the details, but we have signed on to promote expectations on deforestation. And we have also been a signatory seeking to get governments to sign on to climate change with regards to the Paris Agreement. Lastly, as I mentioned before, we have had one of our investment consultants. They're engaged, and hopefully by our August meeting, they will have completed a study to address issues as to with regards to the investment risk associated with climate change. And we expect it will enable us to better advocate on those issues and also to spearhead initiatives that we believe will mitigate climate change. With regards to the legislative proposals that have been put forth, the SBI board has not stated a position, so these are my views, which is what I would be recommending to the board. With regards to the study, pieces of study legislation, I did ask our consultants what the cost of providing the study that's outlined in the three pieces of legislation, and we were given an off-the-hand estimate of between $500,000 and $2 million. One of the things that I'm curious about is would there be an appropriation, and who would pay for that? Some problematic issues with regards to that is that the only way we would find out the actual cost of such a study is by going through the RFP process, which I would estimate would take 6 to 9 months to develop an RFP and to receive responses. I think that's probably the only way to find out what the true cost of that type of study would be. And then there would be need to be time to have the study performed. So I don't think that the due date that's outlined in the study is realistic. With regards to the impact that I believe it would have on the portfolio, it's difficult to ascertain that. It's something that I would presume that would also be attempted if such a study were to go forward. My personal belief is that what I've seen in the past is divestment ideas have not added value to investment programs. My concern is that it would potentially have an adverse impact on our investment programs. With the divestment bill, some of the concerns that I have is that while I understand the nature and desire for divestment, I too, as one who have concerns about the climate, don't believe that the process of having organizations like ourselves divest from these securities actually does anything to mitigate climate change. In effect, all that really happens is that we sell. In most cases, these companies are still extremely profitable and believe that for the next decade or so will continue to be, primarily not because they dig for fossil fuels and transport them. It's because people demand them and use them. Much of what I have seen in discussions I've attended with regards to the investment risks leads me to believe that engagement is a much more powerful way to get the reaction and assistance in getting some changes made. The big difficulty I've got is that much of what I've heard with regards to divestment is we want change. I'm not convinced that that will get the change that's desired. I think all that will happen is that we will sell to people who may have different interest in having change take place. because this is really a demand problem, and we are trying to seek a supply solution to attack it.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate Mr. Perry telling us about his approach to ESG and his engagement approach. I did feel, however, as we got into his comments on the bill, that we typically let the authors present their bill before we take the criticism of the bill. So I'll give him, I don't know if we were going to invite him back, though, so I'll give him some slack there. But, Madam Chair, if I could ask Mr. Perry, what is the extent of the SBI's investment in fossil fuels, and what percentage is that of your total investment?
Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, I don't know the exact number. We pretty much invest in all publicly available stocks in the United States, other developed countries, and emerging markets relative to the benchmarks that we have chosen. So I'd say we would have whatever the energy content, the energy sector is contained in those benchmarks.
And Madam Chair, Madam Chair, Mr. Perry, I thought you told me that was about $2 billion. Did I make that up?
Mr. Perry.
Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, when we spoke, I don't think I gave any specific numbers about the total amount. I did share with you a report that was done by Vermont, but as of yet, we've not received our report, but $2 billion would not be out of line given the size of our portfolio.
And Madam Chair, what is the size of your portfolio?
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, the pension portfolio is today about $68, $69 billion.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Rosen. Mr. Perry, will you share your written remarks with us?
Oh, my scribbles?
Yes.
Madam Chair, my scribbles? Yes, I can have my staff pre it up, and we'll share it with Susan. I did this evening send Susan an investment report, which I think would also be interesting to the commission, written by an energy advocate at J.P. Morgan, which I think will explain. I thought it was somewhat objective, but we'll explain what some of the difficulties would be with reaching some of the mitigation that we seek.
Thank you. I'd appreciate that. And I'll share them with the commissioners. Any other questions for or comments to Mr. Perry? If not, we'll go ahead and have a brief presentation of the two bills that are before us, and then listen to the testifiers. It is my intention to lay the bills over.
Madam Chair, I'm going to have Representative Long make some opening comments while I have a very short PowerPoint, as does my first testifier, and I'll just get that ready.
Thank you. Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. I'll speak briefly to both bills. I think we hopefully all in this room acknowledge the risks of climate change and know that urgent action is needed. There are many different ways to confront the climate change. Senator Frentz and I are partnering on a 100% clean energy bill. Senator Senjum and I are working on an energy efficient buildings bill. But I do think it's important for us to take a look at the risks that climate change poses to our investment portfolio. I want to thank Mr. Perry for his comments about the work they're doing on proxy voting. I think that's important, and glad to hear that they're undergoing some study on the investment risk for climate change. But climate risks are serious, and I think that they are recognized as such by major businesses and investors that are looking into these issues. At the Davos World Economic Forum this year, climate-related risks ranked among the top five of the business leaders and experts that were surveyed there. Munich Re, the reinvestment firm, said that natural disasters and extreme weather caused around $160 billion worth of damage in 2018. And Control Risks, another consultancy, predicts that this figure will be even larger in 2019, from storms to floods to droughts to forest fires, affecting production, distribution, sales, et cetera. These risks have an impact on businesses. There is the regulatory risk that as governments across the world and our government, state governments, are responding to the serious threat of climate change, that they are going to be regulating the industries that are responsible, which include fossil fuel companies. There are also liability risks. The companies are being sued by a number of states, by other governments as well, for damages for some of the climate disasters and other impacts that are being felt to infrastructure around the country. And there's the risk of stranded assets, that as these companies are being required to move away from fossil fuels, that they will be left holding the bag, and then investors will as well. The quote that I found particularly compelling, the Zurich Insurance Group chief risk officer said, "If you were a plastic straws manufacturer a few years ago, thinking about your strategy going forward, maybe you weren't anticipating that consumer sentiment could so quickly and radically move against you. But I think we may find the same thing happening in climate change as we're seeing the public awareness grow of the risks and threats of climate change." In addition to the financial risk for the state, there is a moral element to continuing to invest public money in companies that are causing direct harm to our state. And there is a precedent in our state for addressing moral issues in our investments. We did divest in 1991 from tobacco, and that wasn't for a feeling like tobacco was going to, companies were going to plummet and that we were going to have financial risk, but because of the moral element of investing in those companies. The UN has said that we have 11 years to take dramatic action to reduce climate pollution, or we will not be able to avoid the worst risks of climate change. Minnesota has seen the biggest changes in temperatures across of any state in the United States. Minneapolis, the city I represent, has seen the biggest change in temperatures of any large city in the United States. We've heard testimony in the Energy Committee, of which I'm the vice chair, from University of Minnesota scientists about the impacts that are going to occur in Minnesota to our boreal forests, which, if climate change is left unchecked, could be gone from our state by 2050. Risks to our crop yields, risks to our health from Lyme disease and the spread of infectious diseases, risk to our health from heat island effect, and risk to our economy from extreme weather events. Companies in Minnesota are recognizing this. Xcel Energy is our largest utility, is committed to 100% clean energy. 3M, just a couple of weeks ago, said that they are moving to 100% clean energy as well. And so we, I think, can recognize that large companies are seeing these risks, and we as a state, I believe, should understand these risks and move to address them, both for the risks that they pose to our portfolio and for the moral obligation that we have as a state. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Perry did an excellent job in making his case as to why engagement is a good strategy for the SBI, and we're going to talk tonight about why we think that divestment would be a good strategy. So I'm going to start with this was the first illuminated picture of the whole Earth that any of us ever saw. It was taken on the last Apollo space mission in 1969. It reminds us that we're all connected, that everything we do has an impact on the planet. I'm going to tell you a little story about a frog. You've probably heard this one before. What happens if you drop a frog into a pot of boiling water? It jumps out right away because the water's too hot. But if the water warms up slowly, the frog stays in that pot until it croaks and it cooks. We're just like that frog in the boiling water. Our planet is getting hotter and hotter. We have to turn down the heat right now before everything on our planet gets cooked. The question isn't whether there is climate change. The questions are, must we change, can we change, and will we change? First, how bad is climate change? We dump 110 million tons of man-made global warming pollution into the atmosphere every 24 hours, every single day. That pollution builds up and traps heat. Scientists have understood the basic science of global warming since the 1800s. It's pretty simple. Energy comes to the earth from sun in the form of light. That energy is absorbed by the earth and warms it. Some of that energy is sent out from the earth as heat. Some of that heat is trapped by the atmosphere, which is good. It keeps earth at a stable temperature. But we've filled the atmosphere with heat-trapping pollution. Heat is trapped and can't get back into the atmosphere. The heat is warming the planet at a rate faster than ever. And what is the major source of man-made heat-trapping pollution? The major source is the burning of fossil fuels, which are oil, coal, and gas. And this increase is pretty amazing if you look from the 1950s to now. This coal processing plant emits tons of ash, dust, gas, and carbon dioxide every single day. Fossil fuels still provide more than 80% of the world's energy. We're incredibly dependent on them. We start at the bottom of the picture. We burn fossil fuels. CO2, carbon dioxide emissions rise, and the temperatures rise on our planet. 16 of the 17 hottest years on record have been since 2001. About 70% of the surface of our planet is water, and nearly all of that water, 95%, is in our oceans. Nearly all of the extra heat energy that's trapped in our atmosphere is going into oceans. Storms like hurricanes, typhoons, cyclones pick up water from the oceans, and these storms are stronger and more destructive than ever. Because the air and water are warming, Antarctica's ice cover is melting. The polar bears have nowhere to go. The ice melts and goes into the ocean. The oceans rise, and now cities are at risk from the rising sea levels. These are the top 10 cities at risk from sea level rise. Miami now has what is called sunny day flooding. This is happening along the entire eastern U.S. seaboard, especially New York. New York is the most vulnerable city in the U.S. for coastal flooding, and all the other cities on this top 25 list are in Florida. Small island nations are already in danger. Easter Island in the Pacific Ocean is partly underwater. Fiji, Tuvalu, Kiribati, Vanuatu, and the Marshall Islands are predicted to be completely gone in 30 years. The number of climate-related extreme events has gone up worldwide. We've had the worst fires ever in California, floods, storms, and droughts throughout the country, and terrible disasters all over the world. It was so hot this past summer in Germany, Senator Senjum, that the fish in the Elbe River actually cooked to death. They were like the frog in the pot. The river warmed gradually, and they fried. Fried fish from climate change. I know Senator Senjum spends his summers in Germany, so I wanted to point that out. Some cities won't be livable anymore. The Department of Defense warns about refugee crises, epidemics of diseases, water shortages, and food scarcity. Crop yields are decreasing, especially of stable foods such as rice, corn, and soybeans. The food that is growing isn't as nutritious as it used to be because it's exposed to higher levels of CO2 that destroys the nutrients. Diseases that are spread by insects and by dirty water increase because of the warming climate. Here's our Earth, no longer blue, but on fire. Madam Chair, then now I'd like to turn it over to Vena Canitz, who's a science teacher, and she is also going to, she's going to talk about the Minnesota, if I can figure out the slide projector correctly. Close and go to her PowerPoint. There she is.
Ms. Canitz. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Vita Canitz, and I am a science teacher with 35-plus years experience here at Rosemount High School. I'm also a mother and a grandmother, and someone who's very close to pulling in that pension that you've been safeguarding for me. And I want to tell you that you need to divest, because you need to invest in our children's future. And you need to safeguard my investment, because these fossil fuel investments are risky and not worth the risk. Our students understand the risk They're out there. They're speaking up here in the state of Minnesota and around the world. I'm sure you've seen the pictures. They're also bringing lawsuits before our government to say you should have acted and you haven't. You've been listening to fossil fuels and they're hurting us. The science is clear. Our climate is changing and we are the cause. I won't go into the greenhouse effect again. Senator Pappas did it very well. But you should know that it's not a new idea. It did start in the 1800s. And as a matter of fact, there was a Swedish physicist named Svante Arrhenius who in 1896 estimated that if we double CO2 levels by burning coal, that global temperatures will rise 4.9 to 6.1 degrees back in 1896. Today, scientists know that our choices have consequences. We have 800,000 years of ice core data that shows us a very direct relationship between CO2 and temperatures. In our interglacial periods, temperatures and CO2 rise. As we went into ice ages, they went back down. But look at this graph, folks. We're no longer anywhere near the 180 to 280 that is the normal cycle that we've had on Earth. We're now up at 413 parts per million, 43% more CO2 in our atmosphere, and it's already caused 1 degree Celsius warming. And remember that we've learned that 1.5 is pretty much as high as we dare go. So our choices have consequences. Whether we divest, whether we invest in renewables, whether we change our habits, these are all very, very direct consequences. Do we want our children to inherit the world on the left or the world on the right? That is what we are talking about here. In Minnesota, we've seen some of these impacts. For example, as already mentioned, the Twin Cities has warmed 3.2 degrees since between 1951 and 2012. And we are one of the fastest warming places. Not only our temperatures have increased, but our rain events have changed. We now have many, many more mega rain events. In fact, the Midwest is seeing 37% more rains falling in these heavy rain events than we did just 50 years ago. These rain events and other climate-related disasters have cost a lot of money. You can see the huge, this 20-year period, the cost of climate-related disasters has soared 150%, according to Forbes, compared to the last 20-year period. We have also seen an increase in diseases and vector-borne diseases such as Lyme's disease. Not only the range of Lyme's disease and these vector-borne diseases has increased, but also the incidence. Our Minnesota Department of Health has put a very nice graphic together here showing us the relationship between these changes in our climate and health impacts. Health impacts such as longer growing season, worse asthma, high heat and humidity that, frankly, is a killer with heat stroke. Poor air quality as we see an increase in ground level ozone and, of course, all the issues of poor water quality. So here in Minnesota, we love our lakes and we love our forests, and they are threatened. Our moose, are one of our icons, is threatened by the warming climate. Our fishing, we love to trout fish and fish for walleye. Well, if we allow our lakes and streams to warm, we're not going to have these fish again by mid-century. We have also seen changes in our northern woods, our boreal forest, and are losing our birch, our black spruce, and fir as they tend to only live in far more northern climates. So we do have a decade or less to make serious, serious choices to address this issue, to cut our emissions in half. We need all options on the table. Do the math. Remember Bill McKibben did that, do the math tour a few years ago? Well, he updated his math in 2016. If we want to hold the warming to 1.5 degrees, in 2016, he calculated we have 352 gigatons of CO2 left that we can burn through, okay? But here's the problem. Just existing coal, oil, and gas wells that are currently in operation have 942 gigatons. These fossil fuels and other known reserves must never be used and must become stranded assets if we are to protect our future. So I urge the state of Minnesota to join the over 1,000 institutions, places like Ireland also, right, and whole states like New York that have made the choice to divest. because it's the moral thing to do, because it will help safeguard the safety of our investments and our children's future. Thank you very much.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, we can continue with our testifiers. We have a few more. They're all just going to do like 2 minutes.
And they're going to be short.
2 minutes.
Right. 1 minute?
I'm not that short. I can come next week.
No, go ahead.
No, no, don't sit down.
Okay.
Just do what you have to do. Get this chair. Thank you, members of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement, for allowing me the opportunity to speak on the issue of fossil fuel divestment of our state retirement funds. My name is Gina Penn Tracy. I'm the owner of Centered Wealth, a financial services firm located in Minneapolis. I have actively managed fossil fuel divested portfolios for over a decade. I'll focus my testimony today on fiduciary duty, otherwise known as the prudent person standard, and its application to fossil fuel divestment. The prudent person standard is the legally binding standard of conduct that investment fiduciaries are held to both in the United States and globally. The main elements of the standard that apply to the divestment process are, first, the mandate to assess the future market risks of the current or new holdings in an investment portfolio. Second, the mandate is to adhere to asset allocation models, including sector allocation, such as utilities and energy sectors. The third is to manage the expenses inside of a portfolio in order to produce the best possible outcome for the investor. The Chartered Financial Analyst Institute, or CFA Institute, is the premier global association for training, certifying, and maintaining a code of conduct for investment professionals, including establishing a rigorous definition of the fiduciary standard. In January of this year, the CFA Institute published a position paper on the inclusion of environmental, social, and governance standards, known as ESG, in the investment process. Fossil fuel risk is one aspect of the environmental segment of ESG. In this paper, the CFA Institute states ESG factoring is consistent with a manager's fiduciary duty to consider all relevant information and material risks in investment analysis and decision making. The bill mandating a report on the effect of climate change on investments in state pensions is directly in alignment with the CFA Institute on this issue. A concern over the cost of doing such an analysis should, I believe, be weighed against the potential downside risk of not doing such an evaluation. Before the financial crisis of 2008, risk assessment of mortgage-backed securities was based on the past performance of mortgages, performance that had been consistent for over a century and which overlooked the new types of mortgages being placed into the market. Going into the crisis, mortgage-backed securities were improperly rated because fiduciaries missed the fundamental changes in the mortgage marketplace, and the global economy paid the price. Although there are many voices sounding the alarm today, I have grave concerns that the rising risks facing the fossil fuel marketplace are not being accounted for by the current fiduciaries. The first of these risks is that increasing climate legislation globally will strand assets that are currently on balance sheets, thus lowering the company's valuations. Oil companies value the oil reserves that they hold in the ground. Natural gas and coal companies do the same. If we were to release all of these not yet extracted assets, but those accounted for in the balance sheets of these companies, we would face catastrophic impacts. We would far exceed the 2-degree global warming benchmark cautioned against by climate change scientists. Therefore, at some point, it is likely that these assets will be abandoned. This will cause radical revaluation of the top 200 carbon holding companies that we are requesting be targeted for evaluation and divestment. The next large risk to fossil fuel investments is the potential liability risk as larger and more costly climate-related events unfold globally. The increasing costs of response and mitigation efforts will burden local and national governments and thus increase the pressure to collectively hold these companies liable for the havoc they have wrought by obscuring the science of global climate change in relationship to their products. Much like tobacco companies, municipalities will likely seek to recover damages from these companies. However, unlike tobacco companies, the underlying product will also likely be greatly restricted or effectively banned altogether. The final potential risk is that as fossil fuel actors, including countries, attempt to control the increasingly unstable market for these assets, their behavior will become more erratic and create spikes and crashes in asset values. As entire countries or huge multinational companies pledge to emancipate themselves from fossil fuel-generated power, global demand will continue to decrease. On the other hand, fracking and tar sands extraction is radically increasing both oil and natural gas supply. Lower demand and higher supply always drives down valuations. As we've seen in recent years, companies and countries responding to these pressures do not always make sound decisions. I believe that this volatility is likely to continue. Why am I also backing the Fossil Fuel Divestment Act, which would require divestment begin immediately and be completed by 2024? The growing global divestment movement and the other market forces listed above will likely continue to lessen the marketplace for selling these holdings. As the SBI finds fewer and fewer available purchasers for these assets, the price will potentially continue to be driven downward. Some companies themselves, such as Peabody Energy, are citing the divestment movement as partially causal in their bankruptcy proceedings. What of the argument that these companies may be part of the renewable energy solution? I am a very big believer in shareholder engagement, and I commend Masco Perry and the SBI for making progress in this arena. Unfortunately, in this group of holdings, the risk to investors, I feel, outweighs the potential societal benefits of staying invested and engaging with these companies. Pension funds rely on narrowly targeted performance profiles, and the potential for major market disruption in this asset class is much too high. Both Exxon and Shell recently made appeals to investors to trust them that they are on the road of transitioning to clean power. However, in looking at their balance sheets, their fundamental reliance on potentially stranded assets means that even the most aggressive shifts by these companies to take up renewable energy will likely not save them from radical downward revaluation ahead. Additionally, if the companies targeted for divestment were to substantially shift their asset mix, they would be removed from the divestment list and they could be reconsidered for investment, and at that point, further shareholder engagement would be beneficial. The structure of asset and sector allocation is our best way to align current investments with expectations of future performance. Divestment from fossil fuels leaves an opening for reinvestment into other like sector investments. Fortunately, as with any major shift in technology, there are also potential positive investment opportunities in the clean energy sector. During this transition, however, the new energy investments will not perform the same way that huge, formerly stable investment energy companies have performed. Therefore, it's crucial that the SBI become educated on how this transition inside of their investment portfolios is best approached. Thankfully, there's a large database of research and training options already in place from which to draw expertise. The before-mentioned United Nations Principles for Responsible Investment calls climate change the top investment issue in the world today. They have training programs established in cooperation with the CFA Institute, which are aimed at institutional investment fiduciaries looking to actively engage on this issue. Internal cost is another area of concern when evaluating large-scale divestment and reinvestment strategies. I understand that the SBI utilizes passive investment strategies in order to lower costs in their portfolios. Thankfully, as with other large institutional investors, as they've moved towards divestment, we now have passive investment instruments that follow fossil fuel-free indexes and allow for a passive approach while screening out the top 200 fossil fuel holding companies. For all of these reasons outlined, I believe the two bills before this committee are consistent with the prudent person standard and should be adopted. Fundamentally, we invest in what we believe will and should grow into the future. It is a process of co-creation with the future we wish to see. I believe that whether we like it or not, our future cannot be
cannot include fossil fuels if we are to survive. And as fiduciaries, we must face that reality. For further information, I encourage the members of this committee to look at the full report titled Divestment from Fossil Fuels, the Financial Case. The executive summary is in your materials, and the link is in the footnotes in your handout. This study also outlines the fallacy that divestment would cause lower returns. It also outlines the radical changes in performance of fossil fuel investments seen in the past decade. Thank you for your consideration.
Madam Chair, the next three testifiers could come up as a group. They're public employees who are concerned about their investment portfolio.
Senator Pappas, Representative Long. I am going to hear every person that comes before us. But when we discussed before, you said everyone would have 2 minutes. And we are far beyond that at this time. And I understand what you're saying. We have the planet to save. But we also have to return here tomorrow. The next person on the agenda is Ms. Wenzel. And I hope to be done by 6 minutes from now.
Madam Chair, members of the board, Melissa Wenzel, Board of Water Soil Resources, previously Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Divesting from fossil fuels is a Minnesota value, a state employee value, and voted in overwhelming support by MAPE, Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, at our delegate assembly in 2016 and 2017. I'm not here just for my own pension, even though I still am. The reasons that make this fiscally responsible is also something that makes us a benefit to the environment and to our children. I cannot sit back and do nothing. I'm here to use my voice to do something. In 2018, NPR reported that renewable energy is the number two source of energy in Minnesota, behind coal, and surpassed nuclear power, wind, solar, etc. Wind power is actually cheaper than coal right now, even without subsidies. Do you want to see an increase in coal and nuclear power plants or reusable energy? What do your kids want, your grandchildren want? I want State of Minnesota's employees' pensions to reflect our values, our investments, and our priorities to our children and our earth. This also happens to be a fiscally responsible thing to do from the research I've looked at. I want you to please support divesting from fossil fuels. Thank you.
Ms. McGill, or Mr. McGill.
Madam Chair and members of the Commission, my name is David McGill. I am here before you on behalf of St. Paul Public School Children. I work at this institution's namesake school, Capitol Hill, just blocks from here. I'm here as a member of the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association. I'm here as a teacher of science, and I'm here as a father. And I'm here to encourage you to move these two bills, or these four bills, the House and the Senate bills, forward. As a member of SPTRFA, I believe it is prudent to shift away from fossil fuels investments to free up money for clean energy investments. Especially in the face of market declines and increased instability in the fossil fuel markets, I believe it is prudent to believe our state climatologist, Mark Seeley, who tells us that Minnesota has the fastest changing climate in the nation. I believe a changing climate, because of its pervasiveness, and perhaps, unlike any other market threat, poses substantial risk to insurance, real estate, healthcare, transportation, infrastructure, and ag sectors, as we have already heard from Senator Pappas. I believe the stability of our pension, our environment, and our community are linked. I am here as a teacher of science. I believe it is prudent to take these actions on behalf of our children. Today, as I do every day, I stood in front of 140 kids ages 7 to 13. Sometimes I ask them what science is. Nature, chemicals, lab coats, volcanoes, and blowing stuff up are usually at the top of the list. And sometimes we do blow stuff up. But in fact, if they truly want to know what a scientist is, these young people might look in the mirror because they are curious, open-minded, not yet hesitant to change their minds in the face of evidence. I tell them science is not like the other subjects they study in school. In science, nobody gets to declare the truth of anything. In science, the claims we make are only as good as the evidence and reasoning we bring to the argument. And I tell them the scientific evidence for human-induced climate changing is overwhelming. I also introduce them to a new vocabulary word, consensus, and I explain that the consensus on human-induced and potentially catastrophic climate change is as overwhelming as the evidence. And finally, I'm here as a father whose son has through his whole life heard him voice concern about this issue, and when the time comes for him to ask, well, Dad, what did you do about it, I will at least be able to say that I raised my voice. We live in a time of radical, unprecedented, and perilous change in our climate. If we, the citizens of Minnesota, and as the only body in a position to act not only as fiduciaries but as stewards of our children's future, if we will not look at the stability and security of these issues and to the external costs associated with continued reliance on fossil fuels, then who will? We, our government, all of us collectively, on both sides of the aisle, both sides of the table, Congress, commissions, committees alike, nobody outside these narrow halls makes a distinction. And they shouldn't, except for one thing. The bills are before you now. Please support these bills. Thank you.
Ms. Geist.
Hello. My name is Kathy Geist, and I don't know how I'm going to condense all this into 2 minutes, but I'm going to do my best. I teach environmental science and biology at Minneapolis Community and Technical College, the most diverse campus in our state, and the core of my teaching is the amazing diversity of life on Earth, life on our planet. We share this Earth with millions of other species, yet as only one species, we are causing increasingly harmful impacts on the rest of life. I am grateful to be here today. Thank you so much for giving us extra time. I'm also a former St. Paul Public Schools teacher, and I am currently collecting retirement from the St. Paul Teacher Retirement Fund Association, and I'll speak about that later. Why I'm here today? I'm here obviously because I support these two bills. I'm very happy to see the powerful and practical opportunity we now have to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and prevent further climate change, as much as that will do. We have to be doing a whole variety of things right now to address this most serious issue. I've been teaching about climate change for more than 20 years. I have watched the changes in data. I have watched the IPCC reports. The current one is recommending immediate and extensive action to significantly reduce greenhouse gas emissions in order to keep the average global temperature within 1.5 degrees Celsius of pre-industrial levels. We've already talked about that. I'm also here because of the many students I have taught whose stories from around the world involve impacts of climate change on their personal lives, their families, their countries. We have students from all over the world. Some students have shared in class how their homelands have suffered from wars related to the impacts of climate change, including severe drought, poverty, starvation, and resulting conflicts. Some students call themselves climate refugees as they report the conditions that caused them to have to leave their homelands. Sadly, some students now in the United States have had to leave where they grew up because of the huge extreme storms and fires in various places in the United States. I'm here because of the myriad of non-human animals, plants, and other organisms, which nobody, well, no, I won't say nobody's talked about, but I seem to focus on that because that's truly my passion, and the that are at being endangered or eliminated by the effects of climate change. And here's a way that I personally relate to this. I hope that there's time for this. I really, this is such a beautiful species of pikas. Does anyone know what a pika is? It's a small mammal related to rabbits who live above timberline in the mountains of Colorado, where I used to hike. The pikas can only tolerate a range of cooler temperatures and thus live on the mountaintops. As the climate warms, they are not able to climb any higher. The warming climate is, of course, caused by us as we continue to not take the actions needed to prevent further climate change. Divesting from fossil fuel companies whose impacts are experienced around the world is a key action with measurable benefits. Finally, I'm here because I retired early from St. Paul Public Schools and began collecting my pension when I turned 65 years old. In examining the investments of the St. Paul Teacher Retirement Fund Association, I then realized I had a strong ethical conflict with collecting my pension, knowing that a percentage of that pension came from fossil fuel investments. I have dealt with this reality by donating this approximate percentage of money to environmental organizations focused on climate change, and also sharing my concerns with the Retirement Fund Association. However, this is not a permanent solution by any means. In summary, I cannot deny that it's time to intervene on the increasingly significant economic, ecological, and social costs of our pension plans and other funds being invested in fossil fuel companies. Putting off the crucial changes we need to make is not a viable option, especially when these changes are essential to all of life on Earth, not just us. Thus, I strongly support these critical House and Senate bills.
Ms. Zimmer.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Murphy, for your patience. My name is Catherine Zimmer, and I'm an environmental health specialist or an environmental health scientist, and I'll just be really brief and tell you that I am terrified of climate change. My concerns revolve not only about human health, which is my professional arena, but also for the biodiversity and ecosystems on which all life depends. I am personally doing everything I can to ameliorate climate change, and as a matter of fact, I divested my personal retirement investments from fossil fuels 5 years ago. And I will say that those investments are doing just fine. They're doing very well, and of course, I sleep a lot better at night. I think that the information I have gathered about divestment is it's an excellent way to encourage fossil fuel companies to move us beyond these planet-killing fuels to more environmentally friendly strategies. And actually, I will call out that this strategy was successful in ending apartheid in the early 90s. In closing, I'm going to say that as a public employee and pensioner, I wholly support the divestment of our pensions. Fossil fuel investments are highly risky from both an economic and environmentally sustainable point of view. And I'd like to thank Representative Long and Senator Pappas for introducing this legislation, and thank you for your time and patience.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Thank you, Senator Pappas. Thank you, Representative Long. Thank you, Mr. Perry. This issue is going to be laid over. Next Tuesday night, the commission will meet again at 5 o'clock, and we will end at 7 o'clock. And we will publish the agenda as soon as we have it, and it'll probably be in the next couple of days. We will end next Tuesday night because there's another meeting at 7:15 on claims. And so we cannot go over next week. Thank you for your attendance. This meeting is adjourned. Gracias.